भद्रं हरणे पश्यामदेवाः भद्रं पश्ये माक्षभेर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः व्यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः.
So just repeat after me so you can say it. I'll say it breaking the sandhi. Okay.
Amatrah.
Amatrah.
Chaturthah.
Chaturthah.
Avyavahariyah.
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 Papanchopashamah.
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 Shivah
Advaitah Evam Aṅkārah Ātmā
Eva
Sandishati Ātmanā
Ātmānam
Yah Evam Veda. So just to review this verse, the English translation. Amatraha, that which has no mantra, a-u-m, the silence, it has no letter, so it's not circumscribed by anything, so limitless, it's not contained by anything, or limited by anything. Amatraha, that amatraha is the chaturtha, the fourth pada. That fourth pada, from the standpoint of the om, the silence from which the om rises and sets, from the standpoint of Ishwara, the Brahman, just the Satchitananda, which is the very self, the very Adhishtana of the whole creation. It is Avyavaharyaha, because from its standpoint there is no duality at all, there is no second thing for it to be engaged in any type of activity, so it's Avyavaharyaha. It's Prapancha Upashamaha. It's that where the whole prapancha is in a state of complete resolution. Okay? It's where the prapancha itself is not manifest, prapancha upashamaha. It's the avyakta of the avyakta. It's the unmanifest self in which the unmanifest maya resides. So there's the avyakta of the paramatma, of the self, the non-dual self, the satchitananda atma. And then there's the avyakta of the karana, the karana sharira, which is really Ishwara, the maya in unmanifest condition. So maya in unmanifest condition, in om is the makara, a-u-m. That makara, the a and the u, resolve into the makara. Just like the virat in Hiranyagarbha, you know, the waking state and the dream state, they resolve into the deep sleep state. So when the deep sleep is there, virat and Hiranyagarbha are in unmanifest condition. But the makara, the unmanifest condition itself, resolves into the silence of om. So when I say the fourth mantra, we have the a and the u resolving into the makara, om. But then the om resolves into the silence, the very adhishtana, the very silence, which is the adhishtana, the basis that is holding the whole syllable om. So om rises from silence, is held in silence and resolves into silence. So silence is the adhishtana that is present through all three mantras. Like that conscious being, Brahman, the self that I am, is what is present to all of the three states of experience, the waking state, the dream state, the deep sleep state. So I am the waker, I am the dreamer, I am the deep sleep, I am the deep sleeper, but you can't say that for the three states of experience. The waker is not the dreamer, right? The waking state is not the dream state. And the waking state and dream state are not the deep sleep state. And yet I am the self of all three. And so I become the adhishtana of the truth that has that anuvritti, that continuation through all three states of experience. And that one is the conscious being that is the self of all three. Like that in the om, The silence, right, is what is present in all three letters. All three of these take place in silence. That's why we say, you know, japa is the repetition of the mantra. My mantra doing japa is so powerful, because what you recognize by the repetition of a mantra is first silent, it's mantra silence, mantra silence, mantra silence, mantra silence. But that, over a short period of time, resolves into mantra rising and setting in silence. And so the silent adhishtana, that silent basis, is with japa easily differentiated from the mantra. And then what's so powerful about that is the mantra really, even though it's a spiritual mantra and it has, it brings to mind your knowledge, you know, or it brings to mind Ishvara, whatever the mantra happens to be. You know, it's better than saying pencil, pencil, pencil. But nevertheless, the mantra really stands for any thought. A mantra is a thought. And so if you can recognize that, the silent avyavaharya, the silent self, which is not engaged in any activity whatsoever, you know, as the self of the mantra, right, that silent self of the mantra, then you can recognize that you get to know that. You get to know yourself. And the mantra eventually, just some time, will just drop off, and then you're just in a meditative state, you know, and at that point you can introduce something like, I am Brahman, or I am Chaitanya Mahan, I am consciousness, I am Shanti, you know, whatever words work for you to just help the mind to continually resolve into your own being, so you can get used to yourself in a way. Well, that's Nididhyasana, even being able at the end to be able to say, I am Ishvara. If I can say, I am Ishvara, you know, from the standpoint of really myself, the Atma, recognizing my being as the self in all beings, then that is what we call, you know, really meditation. It gives me a chance to really own my knowledge. But here, when you're doing something like japa, what you start to recognize in terms of this inner space of your antakarana, the inner space of your mind, that your self is always silently abiding there. It's the very adhishtana. Adhishtana means the truth of it, the changeless truth of the maya, the changeless truth of the mithya thoughts. You know, it becomes differentiated. When that differentiation takes place, what happens is, and this is where we're going to be going here, you enter yourself as yourself. So I'm going to talk about that in a minute. So here, in any case, prapancha upashamaha. The whole prapancha really resolves into that adhishtana upon knowledge. The prapancha itself becomes mithya. When you're in contemplation, the whole prapancha, prapancha means the world, everything that exists within duality, right? It resolves, as I started saying, the a-u-m, the makara, which is the avyakta, the a and the um resolve into the makara. The makara itself resolves into just conscious being. So conscious being is the adhishtana, the basis for the entire prapancha, either from the name a-u-m or from Virat Hiranyagarbha Ishvara. All of the whole duality, the whole maya resolves into what is its truth, what is its source. And that chaturta, that fourth state, which is the Atma, is Shivaha. Shivaha means that which is most auspicious, that which is Ananda. Ananda means that which is whole and complete. So that prapancha upashama is Shiva, that which is the Ananda. It is Advaita, non-dual. There is no second thing. There are no parts. There is no duality between satyam and mithya. What is mithya is anything that comes into being and goes out of being. It means it has no being of its own. It's bordered by non-existence. Anything that can be experienced, anything that's subject to change, the existence that it is enjoyed is, in a sense, a borrowed existence. Borrowed in the sense that it fully enjoys that being when it is there. The being, though, doesn't come and go. The nama-rupas, the names and forms that we experience in the creation, even in terms of in mental conditions, emotions, anything that's objectifiable, The being that it enjoys is full and complete when it is present. But all of these things that are objectifiable, anything that exists in duality, is only present momentarily. Right? When it is present, it enjoys being fully. There is no separation between it and being, existence. Conscious being, okay, just being is good enough for now. But when it goes, it no longer enjoys being, but nothing has happened to being. So it's true for any thought you have. The thought, the experience goes, you're still there. It's a simple way of saying it. The thing is, who's still there? That's what we don't think about. You know, it's like, Swamiji uses the example of the mind being like a monkey, you know, swinging from vine to vine. And since it's swinging from vine to vine, it's that associative thinking, it has no time to realize the adhishtana. And so one thought morphs into the next thought, into the next thought, into the next thought, to the next thought, and all of the thoughts, this chain of thoughts, all of them have being. Right? There's no space in between. So you don't think of one thought rising and setting in being remaining. You just see that all thoughts have being. All change has being. Nothing lacks being. You don't realize that all of the experiences that you're having are coming into being and going out of being. See what I mean? You're seeing like the movement as though, as change takes place, being is there. Everything enjoys being. There's nothing that doesn't enjoy being. And that's what that's how we think. It's so obvious that we don't think about it. Of course everything enjoys being. Being is the thing. It's not that everything even enjoys being. Being is the thing. There's being because this is. But when we start analyzing the reality of our experience, all of these things that we have given being to, it's like being is because this is, we start to recognize that there is a different type of relationship, that the being is actually the adhishtana. It's actually it's the stable isness which all things are enjoying. It's a shift in your recognition of your experience of reality. There's a shift that takes place where you recognize conscious being, which is yourself, is the adhishtana, and every experience that you have is coming in and out of it. That means there's been a viveka. And so in the recognition of that, there is the recognition as we unfold it, not right away, as it's unfolded, the recognition of what we mean by Advaita. Advaita means non-dual. Being itself, existence itself, has to be non-dual for a number of reasons. The main reason is that the being that you enjoy is not something objectifiable that you can look at and differentiate from something else. I can't objectify being and talk to you about it. Right? I can't objectify being, nor can I separate being from anything that's perceived. I can't objectify it, nor can I separate it from any experience that I have. In this sense, I can't objectify it, so it's not an object in the world. But there's also no object in the world that doesn't enjoy it. See, that's a very interesting thing. I can also be with just being itself. I can differentiate being itself. But from the standpoint of the world that I perceive, I can't perceive the world or relate to the world separate from being. That's the satyam mitya. That's why, in fact, I can have like a nirvikalpa samadhi. If I want to even go there, I don't need to go there, but I can have a nirvikalpa samadhi where I am just pure being. But an even more simple than that, I can close my eyes. I can close my eyes and immediately from my experience, all nama-rupa, name and form, is gone. From my experience. Not from Ishwara, but from my subjective experience, it is gone. In fact, through contemplation, See, this is an interesting thing. If I close my eyes, I have very easily eliminated from my experience name and form. I have not eliminated my being. So in fact, in a way, just like when you're waking up from the dream, if you close your eyes, name and form are removed, but what is actually here isn't. In other words, there's no loss. Your eyes are open, you close your eyes, there's no loss. In meditation, in terms of what is actually there, in terms of the experience, in contemplation, one thing that is that we do, or needs to be done if it's not done, is that going to the satya mitya again, recognizing, going back to this so that you'll really follow me. With my eyes open and when I'm experiencing the world, everything in the world enjoys existence. I can't separate the world from existence, from being. But being, I cannot see. Existence, I can't see. But in the end, the existence that I'm giving to the world, experientially, it's the existence that I'm giving to the world, experientially, is not non-existence. The existence that I'm giving to the world is experientially my own being. I can't see existence. I can't objectify existence. I can only be existence. So my own amness, in fact, you can say I can objectify my physical body. I can objectify my sense organs. I can objectify my mind, my thoughts, all the whole world I can objectify. But my being, I can't objectify, but my being, my amness, is self-evident. Because I'm not going to say that I am not. I can say the body is objectified, and the body is, the sense organs are, the thoughts are, I can watch all of these coming and going, in the end I'm going to say, and I am. This amness is not objectifiable as the body, the mind, and the sense organs are. And so, what is this amness? What is this non-objectifiable experience of me? Why do I know I am? What is lighting it up? Right? That's why we say the amness that I am is self-evident. In fact, it's self-evident me. It's self-evident consciousness. That's why in contemplation, as you relax and withdraw all of your sense organs, basically the best way to do that is just through the depth of relaxation as you're withdrawing all of these perceptions, relaxing your body so that it's not calling your attention, relaxing your mind so it's also not calling your attention, you know, so that then what's happening is just the only thing that is there, you're kind of removing what is objectifiable, and the only thing that is left in your experience is just your own simple presence. And then, in fact, it's a beautiful meditation to when you've so relaxed so that the body's not calling your attention, or the mind, or the unconscious also is not calling your attention, because you've acknowledged your unconscious also, so that's also relaxing. Then what is happening is you're just simply there. We don't even really think about it. When we do meditation, we have to push a little bit beyond that, but the first thing to recognize is to get rid of everything else that's in your way, that's like a distraction, so that you can just be. Right? So you're just simply there. And then if you ask, let your mind ask, who's illumining me? How is it that I am and I am self-evident? I'm just self-shining. There's nothing behind me illumining it. And when I'm just with my own presence, are there two of me there? We don't think like that normally. But is there one of me or two of me? And does my own presence have any parts? Does it have any dimension? Well, these are questions for your mind to ask. Your mind is very good, you know, the mind is objectified, They can question all of these things, okay. But talk about yourself. Why shouldn't it? It talks about everything else. Why can't it talk about your own nature and ask these questions? How many me's are there? There's many thoughts. There's many little unconscious children inside. You know, there's many moods. But how many selves? You'd say, there's just me. There's one self. Do I have any parts? And, you know, my mind can be divided, my body can be divided, but what about me? Do I have any parts? I'd say, no. Do I have any size? The body has size, and I can even make dimension in the mind. But what about just me? Does the word size apply? And in the end, as you sit with your own being, these words are totally irrelevant. I'm not big or small, and I don't have any parts. There aren't two of me, you know. That's what we mean by non-dual. There's just not two of me in any way. In any way that I cut it, there's not two. I don't have any parts. There's not another me there. Right? I don't have any size. I'm not big or small. These words are all totally irrelevant.
Mm.
But then you can say, yeah, but there's this world of experience. That makes two. We say, no, it doesn't make two. Because the world of experience, whether it be a dream or waking state or even deep sleep state with the dream and waking state come in and out of, those experiences have no being of their own. They have no reality of their own because every experience that I have, without exception, other than being itself, comes into being and goes out of being, yet only enjoys being for that moment when it is present. When it's gone, it doesn't enjoy any being. It comes into being and it goes out of being. And there's nothing in the Vyavahara, in the physical world, or in the subtle world of my mind that doesn't fit into that reality. Because the physical world also is coming into being and going out of being. The mental world also coming into being and going out of being. The emotional world coming into being and going out of being. There is no experience that doesn't fit into that category. But anything that, if we analyze anything that's subject to change, that means it has a birth and a death. And what was its prior condition? Well, its prior condition, it did not have a prior condition because it came into being and went out of being. But the self which it enjoys, the self which it enjoyed, didn't come into being and out of being. And so it from the truth of it, has no prior condition. From its truth, there is no prior condition because its truth is the very being which it is enjoying at that moment. And that being doesn't come into being and go out of being. So being doesn't have a prior condition. You'd say, I, myself, I don't have a prior condition because I'm not mitya. I'm not subject to coming and going. And so this self, we say, this self which is Advaita, is the very self which the entire creation enjoys. And we say this prapancha upashamaha. Upashampaha means everything in the creation resolves into that. Every moment resolves into that. That is its truth. It has no truth of its own. It's mitya. And that which it is, that Advaita, that me, that self which it resolves into, is Shiva. Shiva means, when we say that which is most auspicious, Shiva is the Ananda. Ananda is not a bliss state. Bliss states come and go. Ananda is the very swarupa, the limitless nature, unbounded nature of my being. When we say unbounded, unbounded doesn't mean big. It means that there's nothing else. To being, it's absolutely free because there's no second thing. But when there's no second thing, we're not talking about spatially large. We're talking about non-dual. Non-dual you doesn't fit into concepts of large or small. And the to even recognize what I'm talking about there. You just have to, the only way to recognize it is just to be with your own self, just to relax and just be with this me, and ask, are you big or small? Do you have dimension? The words are inapplicable to you. Those words exist only in the creation. So then he says, having gone through these, it says, evam omkara, and in this manner, the one who knows this omkara, he who knows the omkara, the om, in this manner, that omkara, which is the self, he says, atma omkara, evam omkara atma eva, this omkara, in this matter, is the atma. He says, samvishati atmana atmanam, ya evam veda. The one who knows this, the omkara, as the atma, in this manner, that one enters into the atma by the atma. So last week, I talked about this, and the way Swamiji used to teach this, and he could still teach it this way too, but there's other ways to look at it. We talked about it in terms of khanda akara vritti, okay, where the mind takes a thought of the mind through teaching, through this, especially if we use, like, for instance, strict drisha viveka, where I see everything, what can be objectified, and having objectified those things, I'm left continually with me, the subject, having differentiated my nature from what can be objectified. That's called seer-seen differentiation. It's one teaching methodology where I'm just, all of a sudden, as I go through this process of objectifying the body and the mind, the sense organs and the mind, all the while recognizing my, experiencing my subject as though moving more inward, the mind is left having objectified everything, then, you know, with kind of the tenth man, you are the tenth man, being pointed out in terms of the Upanishad saying, you know, that is you. That is you, the one who is left, you know, the subject that is left having objectified all of these other things. Once I objectify the body, then the subject is not the body. Once I objectify the sense organs, the subject is not the sense organs. Once I objectify the mind, the subject me is not the mind. Because I'm watching it. I'm watching the body, I'm objectifying the body. I remain as the body changes and moves. I remain as my sense organs are active. I remain as my mind is thinking. So now that allows me to differentiate the mind, to differentiate itself from the one who is not away from the self, not away from the mind, but who is illumining the mind, who itself is not changing when the mind changes. If I'm not changing, if I'm the luminary, the conscious being because of which the mind is known, and I recognize the mind itself is recognizing, well, I'm changing, there's thoughts going on, I'm the one who is known, I myself have known, this is the mind talking, I am known, I am objectified, I am continually changing, but the I, the me, is not changing. I am the subject. So then the mind says, I am the subject, it's referring to me, the Atma. I, the self, am the subject, but I, the mind, the self is the subject, the me is the subject, the mind is objectified. It recognizes that. Seva too has that viveka. When it has that viveka, then the mind can turn itself like a mirror toward the subject. Instead of filling itself with all things that can be objectified, it resolves itself into the subject. And in doing that, the mind itself, as though it's like holding a candle flame up to the sun, the mind itself recognizes the difference between itself and its content, the me that is illumining it. It recognizes that. So this is called an akhandakara vritti, where the vritti no longer has any type of objectification. Right? It's akhanda. The subject-object has totally resolved there because the subject, the object of the mind is the subject. So you have the, there is no subject-object relationship anymore. And so the mind recognizes my own nature as free from the thoughts and the sense organs and the body and the world, for that matter. So it recognizes the non-dual nature of myself. So when we use this akhanda akara vritti, that's using the atmana by the atma here. Atma means mind. So the self enters he who knows this, he enters the self by means of the mind, which has that akhanda akara vritti. There is no really entering, because with that akhanda akara vritti, what happens is the mind and body and sense organs are objectified. Right? They are differentiated from my being. And so what happens there is the ahankara, the I notion, that had belonged to the mind and body and sense organs, now resolves into the self, into the self that I am. Until that point, the self that I am, is one with the body, one with the mind, one with the sense organs. It's called karya karana sangata, this body, mind, sense organs conglomerate, right? This is where the I is residing. That I, the ahankara, enters into as though the atma. The akhandakara vritti, there's an as-though entry in the self, only in the sense that the ajnanam is removed and the self that I am now receives the aham, whereas the I, whereas before the aham was the ahankara, is identified with the body, mind, sense organs. And so that's one way of meaning he enters the self by means of that akhanda akara vritti. Swamiji used to teach it that way. The other way is to teach it like this. He enters, the one who knows this, he enters the self just like the rope, the snake enters the rope. Upon knowledge of the rope, the snake, where does it go? Upon knowledge of the rope, where does the snake go? Well, it enters into the rope. Okay. So here, upon knowledge of yourself, where does the misconception go? Where does the ahankara go? Where does the misidentification go? Right? So the misidentification of I am the body, I am the mind, I am the body, mind, sense organs, that body, mind, that misidentification, that ahankara, resolves into the self. Right? The self that has always been there. The self that the mitya has always been. The self that the upadi had always been, right? That upadi, which means that from a subjective standpoint here, because this is now an Ishwara Srishti, right? This is in Ishwara's creation. So what's going to happen is the misidentification of the mind, that anyonya adhyasa, that superimposition, resolves into me, just like the snake resolves into the rope. The only one there that's left there is the rope. The only one that's left here is me, the me that I've always been. But that me was taken by the mind to be this body, mind, sense, or things like that. Now there's one other thing about this samvishati. He who knows in this manner, samvishati, he enters the self by means of the self. In other words, the snake resolves into the rope, if we take it that way. But the samvishati, if we're taking it either way, Swamiji taught, the samyak, Vishati means he enters really well. He enters completely, never to come back again. Right? The reason, so what's understood here is that when a person gains, when a jiva gains self-knowledge, again, you have to realize, if I say the jiva enters into the atma, that's a good one. The jiva enters into the atma like the snake enters into the rope, because there is no jiva. not in reality. The jiva is only ajnanam. When the ajnanam is removed, what is left is the self of the jiva is Brahman, right? The self of the jiva is not, there is no individual self there. The self of the jiva is Brahman. So this jivatvam, like the snake, enters into the rope. But now, the self that you are, now that this ajnana has been removed, but with or without the ajnanam, with or without that ignorance, the self that you are has never been born and never will be born. It's not subject to birth and death. It's not subject to time. So the being that you are is the being that you are. It's never been born. It's never been died. It's never died. It's not subject to objectification. So this me, the self that you are, is the constant. It's the adhishtana of the whole mitya, of the whole creation. So from this me, you cannot come out again. You've never come out before anyway. The me that you are has always been me, free of time, timeless, changeless. And so for a jiva, jiva means that the jivatvam and the ahankara are based in ajnanam, in ignorance, self-ignorance. And so just like for a jiva, when you go to sleep, and then you wake up, you resolve into ajnanam, and you wake up out of ajnanam, ignorance. Right? So, you know, every day is the same, in a sense that I've come back. The one that went to sleep has now come back. Well, it's the same when you die, because the ajnanam has not resolved. The sukshma sharira, the subtle body, you know, the physical body drops when you die, right? But the sukshma sharira, which also is based in ajnanam, the same ajnanam, you know, that sukshma sharira takes a physical body, then that body dies, the sukshma sharira, you know, still has exactly the same ajnanam, nothing has happened there, and it continues to transmigrate. You know, there might be times when the body drops that the sukshma sharira can go into a causal condition, come out of the causal condition, or it can just be transmigrating to take another body, which is appropriate to whatever loka, whatever world it's in. It keeps on moving and transmigrating. There's no removal of ajnanam, and so there's no resolution of the jiva at all. But what about for the jiva that gains self-knowledge? Who's going to transmigrate? Because the ajnanam has been removed. In fact, for you as a jiva, because of the prarabdha karma, which has caused this physical body to take a birth, from the sanchitta, the prarabdha karma, you know, manifests, and you take a birth, the prarabdha karma takes you all the way through the life from birth to death, just the main flow of your life from birth to death. When you gain knowledge, you know, that prarabdha karma is still in operation. Otherwise, when you gain knowledge, if it's a subjective projection, like the snake on a rope, when you gain knowledge, the snake goes away. When I gain knowledge of the rope, there is no snake, because there never was a snake. The snake is subjective. It's mitya. And here, in this case, it's subjective mitya. And so when I gain knowledge of the rope, the snake goes away, because it was mitya. It doesn't have any being, and you can only have that mitya maya manifest with ajnanam. See that? And so subjectively, if I gain knowledge of a subjective projection, if I gain knowledge of what we call the adhishtana, what is actually there, projection goes away. But here, because of the prarabdha karma, this physical body, mind, sense organs is not my subjective projection. This is Ishwara. Now, otherwise, I mean, that would be interesting. You know, if this would be a subject, then if this is a subjective projection, so is this, and so is this, and so is this. Then I have some control over that. But I can't wish this table away. It's some sort of magic. I mean, I can physically remove the table, you know. I could physically harm this body, but not mentally, since this is in Ishwara's physical reality. That being said, what happens when you gain knowledge? self-knowledge, and the ajnanam is removed. The ajnanam, which is the very cause of your transmigration, right? The ajnanam is what causes the jivatvam, that state of being a jiva. So for you, the ajnanam is removed. But my body is still here, the sense organs are still here, the mind is still here, and it will be until the prarabdha runs out. And so what has happened to me when I remove that, when that ajnanam is removed? Well, the subjective part of the ajnanam is removed. The part that projects the jiva srishti on the ishvara srishti, that's removed. See what I mean? Internally, what is it? The mind is there, the self is there, right? The self-knowledge is there for the mind. And so the way the mind is still there, but the way the mind used to behave, you know, when it saw a snake instead of a rose, is different than the way the mind behaves or relates to the world when it doesn't see that snake. And so when my mind recognizes the stability of my own being, you know, there's so many things that are involved in this, so many different things we recognize when we're talking about it in terms of the creation. But say, my mind is awake to the stability of my own being and the ananda, the wholeness of my own being, that's what we call aparoksha. It's self-evident. It becomes self-evident because the ajnana has been removed. So that is self-evident. My mind no longer needs to find my wholeness. I don't have to try to make the world provide me with my well-being. That's a tremendous freedom for the mind. It's not that there aren't pleasurable situations and difficult situations, but as a full person, I'm experiencing these situations rather than as a searching person, you know, a seeking person, seeking for my wholeness. I'm experiencing these situations, but I'm not seeking for my wholeness, as a whole person. I experience these situations. What about the creation? The whole relationship with the creation is totally different because now I see this body, mind, sense organs as part of a bigger picture that we call Ishvara. And so this body, mind, sense organs, this entirety of the experience belongs to a greater whole. And that greater whole, and so you experience this greater whole as Ishvara, that this body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of. And that greater whole is as much me as all of the parts in it are. Just like your dream, if you have a dream, the whole dream is as much you as all of the parts in the dream. Like say you have a dream, and in the dream you're identified with a part. You're a character in the dream, right? And so now you come to therapy and I'm analyzing the dream. What we did, what do we recognize? Is that every part of this dream is me. The whole dream comes from me, the sustained by me, resolves into me. I am the dream. And then if I'm identified with a character in the dream, right, then I'm also that character. I'm that character in the dream and I'm the whole. So here in our position, right, we don't have this Archimedean point, so to speak, to look at ourselves. We have to recognize it right here within it. That this body, mind, sense organs, all of the karmas, everything that I experience, is part of the greater whole, which is also me. Not also me, it is me. And so what happens is as you start recognizing and experiencing the creation from this drishti, from this understanding, there's kind of a shift in trust. There's a shift in the trust like this. Who knows better? The big infinite me or the little ignorant one that's trying to figure out what all of this is? you become held by a greater you, a greater you. It's not a greater you in terms of yourself, but it's a greater you in terms of the creation. That's why in Vedanta, the Mahavakya that really is Vedanta, if you're doing Nididhyasana, if you understand this, is that I am Ishvara. I am Ishvara, because it's not this body-mind-sense organ that is Ishvara. The body-mind-sense organs is Ishvara, it's part of Ishvara. But this Ishvara is me, it comes from me, the Atma, the Self, is sustained by me, it resolves into me. It is the infinite manifestation of knowledge, the knowledge of Maya, and Maya is my incidental attribute, as Swamiji calls it. My incidental attribute. It's an attribute that doesn't belong to anyone else but me, but is mithya. It doesn't change or harm me in any way. But it is infinite. It is infinite knowledge. It's a thing to understand what we mean by infinite knowledge is when you think about it, when you have a dream, we could use imagination, but if you have a dream, that dream comes from your knowledge, what you have inside. Right? If that's missing inside, if those parts and situations aren't inside, you know, in your chitta, in the memory, then it can't come. And so when the dream comes, what is coming is a whole picture, whatever it may be. It's a whole picture. And there are many players in that picture. But the whole picture is the reality, so to speak, the vyavahara, the empirical reality, in which all of the players are playing. Right? And the players, if you kind of imagine like this, they're all of the players in the dream have some, perhaps, freedom within that total dream. But there's a story going on that doesn't allow for a lot of leeway. See what I mean? The story of the dream is more powerful than any one player in the dream. The dream is not being dreamt by a jiva in the dream. The story is being dreamt by the Ishvara of the dream. Right? And so the characters in the dream are pretty bound by the totality of the story. Even if you, when we say here in this creation here, if you say we have free will, we do have free will. Because we can make choices, but the choices that we make are contained in the prarabdha karma, which pretty much limits, you know, or puts kind of brackets around the freedom of choice. In other words, you can have free choice, free will, that's all fine, but it's very contained within a tight structure. If you just think about it, even in terms of the time that you were born, you know, your parents, the time, the place, your parents, your siblings, how the life unfolded for your family as you moved through, and then you find yourself in this given place, and you've probably had this experience as you go through your life. Say you're thinking about moving. It's time you'd like to move. You'd like to move somewhere. Doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. And then at some point, maybe it happens. But it's not like it just goes according to your desire. What about relationships? That's really a funny one. You're in an unhappy relationship. You know? It's time to get out of that relationship. It's time to get out of that relationship. Are you in a happy relationship? You know, you're in a happy relationship. that unexpectedly comes to an end. It's not time to get out of that relationship. What I'm saying, you know, it's just that using the dream analogy, especially if you had like a lucid dream or something, you just see, you know, that there's choice, but the choice is limited by the prarabdha. The choice is limited by Ishwara, the Ishwara of the dream, the Ishwara of this creation. But what is so mitigating of the scariness of that is that Ishwara is me. It's not somebody else. That the self, that is the self of this body, mind, sense organs, the me, this very personal me, it is this me that is the self of Ishwara. There's not two selves. There's only one self. So this is not a foreign creation. This is my creation and everything in it. You know, that's an interesting way also, as you understand that, of relating to every situation that you have. Even your prarabdha karma. Your prarabdha karma is just not you, the physical body, where you find yourself in a situation. Your prarabdha karma is the situation in which you are included. Your body, mind, sense organs are included in the situation. But the prarabdha karma is not just the body, physical body, being born and growing old and dying. It's the situation that body is included in. If you look at a dream that you have, it's not you in the dream, right? So the prarabdha karma, that little jiva in the dream, the prarabdha karma is the entirety of the experience. Yeah? And so all of this, you know, all of this is for each one of us. You know, the prarabdha karma, this is the piece of Ishwara which this jiva is having direct relationship with. This is the part of, because infinite creation, right? This little jiva is only just a little blip on the screen in terms of the infinite creation. So all of us are actually, it's miraculous. Here we are in this infinite creation. In this particular time, we're all here together at this moment. You know, I mean, what are the chances of that? I mean, it's impossible. It's impossible. It's just that this is what it is. See what I mean? There's no, it's an absolutely, when there's billions of people and, you know, and billions of solar systems also, you know, this moment is extraordinary. It's an extraordinarily unique moment, as is every moment and everyone and everything that is part of you in that given moment. And all of it has backed by just one me. It's really, when you think about it, it's an amazing thing. So just to wind this up now. For you, for when this ajnanam is removed, the prarabdha karma is going to continue on because it's Ishwara. It's the big dream. What changes inside subjectively is much different for you. Now because, just like it's different when I see a snake than when I see a rope, when I don't have that self-ignorance, I know myself, I know what Ananda is, I know what this creation is, and my mind relaxes into it because it relaxes into a reality rather than ajnanam. You can't relax into ignorance because nothing works. When you relax into what actually is, it all works. And so then your mind comes to a deep rest. But the prarabdha goes on. When this body dies, who is going to transmigrate? There's no ajnanam there. And so from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs, this jiva, the jiva is not there. The jiva for the jnani, the jiva is not there now. It's mithya. There never was a jiva. There's only Brahman, right? So right now, what jiva is there? There's no jiva. There's just the mithya jiva, the body, the mind, the sense organs. But from the standpoint of the jnani, I am Brahman. I'm not this body, mind, sense organs. The ahankara is gone. The aham resolves into me. The ahankara is just a mithya ahankara. But the I is me, is Brahman, is the self that I am. How can I get that ignorance back? When this body dies, The mind that already enjoys me as Brahman, is it going to stop enjoying me as Brahman and try? You can't get it back. It's like once you see the rope, you can never get the snake back. You can pretend, you can teach all about the snake appearing as a rope, but you try to get the rope back, get the snake back. You can't do it again. Even now, for you, as you know yourself, you can't really get back what it is like to not know yourself. You can teach about it and you can talk about it, but you can't get the experience back again. It's not possible. Because once you know yourself, that ajnanam is gone. You can remember about it and talk about it and teach about it and all of that, just like you can teach about the rope snake. But you can't get it, you can't get the experience of that back. And you say things, how could that ever be possible? How can anybody survive? Can't even imagine what that would be like. But you have to use your memory and all of that type of thing. But you can't get it back because that ajnanam is gone. You see what I mean? You have to think about it. When ignorance is removed, whatever was that condition is now gone. And so you can't have the condition back again. You can remember and talk about it, but you can't have it back again. That's the magic of, with ajnanam, it's something that's beginningless, but it comes to an end. And when it comes to an end, it's gone. And so when this body drops, what brings back the ajnanam to make you a jiva again? So they say all of the elements just go back into the elements. There's no ajnanam to hold that ahankar together again. So that particular jiva is gone. Say, oh no, I don't want to go anywhere. What is left is you. And who are you? You are Ishvara. You are Ishvara, you've always been Ishvara, and you always will be Ishvara. What is Brahman? Some people think, if I lose my body, mind, sense organs, then I'll only be Brahman. So you'll be Ishvara. Brahman is Ishvara. Ishvara has no being apart from Brahman. You're Ishvara. It's just like, say if you're dreaming, sometimes you're just dreaming, you're the whole. Sometimes you've taken a body and you're experiencing the dream from within the dream. Or you're the whole dream. You go back and forth. It's not like when you're the whole dream you think, oh, I'm the whole dream, where's my body? No, you're the whole dream, that's who you are. If you're when you're taking a body, you're not saying, oh, I'm not the whole dream, I'm the body. You don't even think about it. You're going back and forth easily because you are the whole. You are the whole and you're every part of the whole. And so the fact is, just to make everybody feel really comfortable, if that's not comfortable for you, you don't have to worry because you can have as many bodies as you want. As long as you want a body, as long as you want a body, for whatever reason, you can have one. You can have one because that means that for whatever reason in your antakarana, there's something that needs to be done before, there's something that antakarana, that mind needs, before it feels that it can just be. It needs that. There's something it wants. And so that'll form the next trajectory. But there comes a time when you don't really want anything. Anything other than your own being, anything other than Ishvara, that's what you want. You don't want something else. But the mind has its own unfoldment. And whatever things are there, fine. What if it wants to do things for another lifetime, and another lifetime, and another lifetime. Fine. That's not a bad thing. It doesn't make any difference. What makes difference is that you know who you are. That's what makes a difference. And then the mind, because it removes all the suffering, all that fundamental suffering. But as the mind goes on flowering, maturing, at its own rate, then it should be fine. You know, and people sometimes they say, I don't want to have another birth. Because it's as though some sort of sign that I don't really have knowledge. I don't want to have another birth. You know what? I mean, even if... I don't know why I'm talking like this, but I have a question. Even if you have knowledge, but you're not that clear, like Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, he was so afraid of that. You know, Krishna told him, don't worry. You know, don't worry. Even if you're not that clear, and you know, you get killed in battle, it's not a problem. You'll just be born into a house of yogis, people who have knowledge. Or if you still need to work some things out and have some experiences, you'll be born into a dharmic family, and you'll pick up the thread. You'll always pick up the thread. Don't worry. You don't have to worry about it. No. And when you think. This is what strikes me funny. But I think it's a natural concern for somebody who's a mumuksha because they really want to make sure that everything's fine. But what's interesting is, think you've had beginningless lifetimes. There's no beginning to the jiva. Okay, so beginningless lifetimes. That's a lot of lifetimes. Okay. Beginningless lifetimes. And now you're worried about when you're going to... You know, beginningless lifetimes, but now... Is this one the last one, or is it going to be the next one? I mean, we are talking about a blip on the screen compared to the whole creation. So it's just a kind of interesting turn of events.
There's one last sentence here at the end of the Upanishad.
On the handout, I think that was a mistake.
No,
we say that at the end, don't we?
Why that's there is because it's the last verse of the Upanishad.
Yeah.
And then from here on, it's going to be the Karika. Let me see it. Mm-hmm. It's not here in my book.
I thought we were supposed to chant that when the Upanishad was over with.
But we'll chant it, but the Upanishad is going to be continued with the Karika. But this is the last verse of the Upanishad, okay? So it says, repeat after me, Iti. Mandukya Upanishad Samartha. Iti, thus the Mandukya Upanishad is completed.
That's proper.
Okay, let's take a moment. Purnamidam Purnat Purnamidachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
A small question. Arjuna was worried that he would die without gaining this knowledge.
Well, he was feeling clear as Krishna was teaching it to him, but he was worried that when he got out in the middle of the battlefield, that nishta, that clarity, would just go away.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what if there's still emotional lag, lag time dragging on with the...
It depends, really. How much it bothers you. You know?
Oh, yeah.
No, say, what I mean is, say there's a lot of things in your antakara, in your mind, that you, when the body drops, those things aren't ready to just dissipate into the ether, but there's still a lot of holding on to it or that type of stuff, and it's not ready to to let go, then maybe you'll have another birth. Or they say with this Videha Mukti, once the body drops, or Krama Mukti it's called, sometimes there's some things that have to be resolved that don't require taking another body. It can be that, or there's still something that needs to be completed, you know, that you don't end up completing, like a some sort of a desire or a longing that was not completed in this life, was not let go in this life, that could maybe cause another birth. But if there's another birth, you'll just pick up the thread.
Oh, so it's not a worry then?
It's not a worry, exactly. It's not a worry. That's why, you know, sometimes I made this joke that if, you know, some people that come to this knowledge when they're in their 60s, say, and then they do, well, so often they'll say, oh, I wish, remember when I was younger, you know, they would say, oh, I wish I could have come to this knowledge when I was a young person like you. You know, now I've come to this wonderful knowledge and I'm at the end of my life. You know. But here, I was a young person that came to this knowledge, but I can just imagine that when I was, the last life, when I was 60, I was saying, oh, I wish I I wish I would have got this knowledge like you. You pick it, I'm picking at the thread. We're all picking at the thread in one way or another, you know.
I keep thinking about the Dalai Lama and the purpose or the wanting to take a body. And does it always equate ajnana if you're wanting to come back? If you're wanting to take a body, even if you've gained knowledge?
Well, it means there's something unresolved, right?
But is that equal to ajnana? If there's something unresolved, whether it be ignorance or a desire to be,
a vow of the bodhisattva.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking about that, because that's, is that part of dharma, or is that?
There's something in the Brahma Sutras that talk about the prarabdha karma can, some instances, run for more than one life. I don't know how to answer that within another discipline like that, but in the Buddhist discipline, but maybe this could be a helpful way to answer it. In Buddhism, in the Mahayana Buddhism, that bodhisattva belief is there, right? There's also a lot of practice in terms of the sampradaya. The whole teaching is different, right? And yet, said in a different way, within a different containing myth, I would say, there's still the satya mitya. It's dealt with differently, you know, quite a bit differently, but it's still there. And the teaching methodology is different also.
Is the knowledge different?
The context of the knowledge is different. It is different in some ways. The Brahman isn't different. What is going to be recognized is not different, because it is what it is. But the containing myth that the Buddhists hold talks about the bodhisattva, right? That belief is there. There's no reason in the scheme of things of this creation that belief can't be lived out. If I die with, you know, with whatever knowledge I have gained through the different paths of Buddhism, say it's the Mahayana Buddhism, I die having realized something very profound, having realized Brahman is Shunyata, seen it, recognized it through that methodology of teaching. But in that recognition, there is contained
the belief that now I, the one who has recognized this, will continue on as a bodhisattva to serve humanity. What would stop that from happening? Because what I'm saying then is, it's not as though there's not reincarnation, right? So say that that is my firm conviction and that my whole life has been in devotion to that vow. Where is there, in that type of a resolve, where is, I don't know what would stop that from happening. There's devatas, there's lokas, there's all different fields of experience. There's the transmigrating jiva.
But it's by choice or by belief and conviction rather than by ignorance.
We can't even talk like that. You have to talk within the Buddhist tradition.
Okay. You know? Even though the realization is of Brahman.
Well, the realization is of shunyata. Now, see...
Yeah, it's a different system.
Okay, okay, okay.
The shunyata is Brahman, right? But it's within the containing myth of the whole Buddhist belief system. The recognition is within that containing myth. I'm making all of this up. You know, it's not like somebody's told me this, but I'm just kind of putting together something, a logical sequence based upon the nature of the jiva. You know, where does the ahankara for the Buddhist, where does the ahankara lie? Even in the recognition of shunyata, where is the ahankara, where is the aham, what is the aham? In a way, there is no aham. You know? And so there's going to be a relationship where there is a recognition of shunyata, which is the paramarthika shunyata, which is the same as Brahman, it can't be different. You know? And there's a recognition of this creation that has all the characteristics of mithya, but it's not viewed as mithya. Because for it to be viewed as mithya, it has to be related and have for its being Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
It gets complicated, you know. Hal can talk to you more about all this, because he's really studied it. But it does get complicated, you know, when you're trying to compare, because you have to stay within kind of the whole containing myth of that system.
Mm. You know, when they talk about it, Brahman is auspicious, and they use the word
Shiva.
Do we extend that to the Murti as well, the deity, or what is the?
No, when we're using, sometimes when we're saying Shiva, we're meaning Ananda, or that which is most auspicious. We're not talking about Lord Shiva.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it sounded like it.
You think the desire to not take another birth is some kind of obstruction? Anyway? Like an aversion?
If it's an aversion, yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to do this anymore.
They don't want to go through this again.
Yeah.
Is that... that shows some kind of lack of nishta?
Honestly, I'd say there's not a desire one way or the other.
There shouldn't be a desire. There wouldn't be a desire one way or another.
Okay. I don't think so. I don't think it's an important question.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you care?
It would be a rather choice.
No, it's just... Ishwara is what Ishwara is. You know, it's like if the body needs to take another birth, you know, then it needs to take another birth.
Why? What would be? There wouldn't be resistance to that because you need to take another birth. So there would, so you wouldn't be resisting it. So then what would be resisting it would be, the ajnanam part would be, oh, I don't want to take another birth.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That's not right. I shouldn't want to take another birth. Why do I want to take another birth? You know? If you don't want to take another birth, you know, then that question is not going to come up. If you want to take another birth, then you'd think, I want to take another birth. Then the problem would be, I don't want to take another birth. Do you see what I'm saying?
I see.
Because...
what if you really just don't want to take another birth?
Then you're in the right place.
Yeah, but
then you've come to the right place.
Yeah,
but say,
this is your chance.
but say, because initially there can be that type of feeling, because there's a lot of pain in the world, you know.
Exactly.
There's a lot of pain, and so you don't want to go through that again.
Mm-hmm.
But once you kind of worked out a lot of that pain, then you don't really feel like that. It's kind of like a mother who's just given birth, when she's just, you know, just... you know, in the throes of that, what she'll be saying is, never again. I'm never going to do this again. But, you know, when the child is born, or, you know, is, you know, out of the womb completely, then that pain is gone, and she doesn't feel that way anymore. And so when your mind isn't...
But there's not this moment at the time of death where you're making this decision of... This is not a moment of decision that happens when one dies. It takes care of itself.
It's not a moment of decision, because at the time of death, when you're crossing over like that, there's no free will. That's all been, you know, the body is, there's no strength left for that. So it's just what is what is. What you're thinking is what you're thinking. What you're feeling is what you're feeling. So... I think when you don't want to take another birth, it's very simple. You just don't want to take another birth. Or it's more like, instead of, it's not I don't want to take another birth, it's more like I'm not going to take another birth, or there's no reason to take another birth.
Yeah.
But then you would say, no, there's no reason to take another birth. I don't have anything that's drawing me to want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But if I do want to take another birth, then fine. It'd be interesting. Because you already have knowledge, that would be kind of interesting. Then you have to go through all of the pain of the world, being born and going through, you know, the jayate asti, however you're going through. First you're born, this is all human beings, first you're born jayate, then asti, then you are, then you grow, then you go through puberty, then you decay, and then you die. That's it. So do you want to go through all of that? That again, is there something worth that, going through all of that? So I can play tennis, or so I can have my horse. That's what. I can have a horse, I'll do it again. I want my dogs too. But then Tibby has to come. and she has to be a want the dogs. What? Tibbeth? Oh, I don't know. What would she do? I don't know what she's going to do.
I mean, you can wish not to be reborn, but, I mean, obviously, it will be what it will be.
It'll be what it is, yeah.
I mean, that's not in our control.
Yeah.
I feel like somebody asked you this question fairly recently, but I can't remember the answer. Is the trajectory for all jivas eventually liberation?
Well, you can't answer that question, really. You can say yes, but there are an infinite number of jivas. An infinite minus one is how many? Is infinite. And so it's not like you can get down to the bottom of the barrel. But, you know, but on the other hand, from the standpoint of within this creation, all of your experiences culminate really in the end in a desire for liberation. it can take, how long can it take? For us already, it's infinite amount of time to come to that desire, you know?
A friend of mine asked me if I felt sorry for him because he wasn't very spiritual. And I sort of thought, well, you'll eventually, like, I don't know, you'll do what you're going to do eventually. But then it made me wonder, like, I wasn't sure, maybe he wouldn't.
There's no real, that's all Maya. Maya means there's like no way to get to the bottom of things in Maya. It goes in kind of infinitely. Like once you even say there's beginningless births for you, then the mityatva of the whole thing, the Maya of the whole thing starts unraveling. Because if there's beginningless births for you, then at what point, even say for your friend, will there not be beginningless births before that mumukshutvam arises? See what I mean? So beginningless is beginningless. You think that he's been beginningless for longer than you have been beginningless. You see what I mean? It's kind of an odd thing in that way.
Could you explain how does rebirth work for a jiva, aside from a young?
Well, there's the sanchitta karma, which has also been collected from beginningless time. And what the sanchitta karma is all the punya and papa, the what we call the adrishta polas, the unseen results of your actions, you know, in form of punya and papa, are in the sanchitta karma until they're exhausted, until each one of those karmas is actually exhausted. And they're exhausted by coming into the prarabdha karma. They exhaust themselves by becoming prarabdha karma. And so now the question is when, which out of this kind of infinite, you know, sanchitta karma file, which ones of those karmas are going to come in, become prarabdha karma in your next life. So that depends on the trajectory of this life in terms of dharma, really, in terms of dharma and in terms of desire. You know, what would be the appropriate continuation? Like if you look at this life from birth to death, there's kind of a logical sequence of events. They make sense. First this happened, then this happened, then this happened, and this is what caused this to happen. So you can see the thread of your life from beginning to end. But it's that thread continues and has continued. So here's this life, but here's this life, this life, this life. So there's a thread, you know. But within that thread, there's ups and downs based upon dharma, really. You have desire, your desires running along, and then you have dharma and adharma running along, intertwined with the fulfillment of your desires, your raga dveshas. And so, in the kind of the Indian context, it's fine to fulfill desires, but very dangerous to fool around with dharma. Because dharma is what's going to be important, not only for your own shanti in this life, but for the trajectory into the next life. And so if there's a dharma, that's going to set you more in direction of papa or pain, because a dharma itself causes pain. Papa causes pain. Even a dharma in this life subjectively causes pain for you and for others also. And so you'll be attracting that type of a reality that will match who you are, right? And so it's very important in India, I mean for Hindus, dharma is the four purusharthas, you know, there's the four what they call like the goals or what a human being wants. They want artha. Artha is security. So, you know, home, money, good health, just the security, stability. Mm-hmm. Kama is pleasure. If you have the artha, then you want to be able to fulfill desires. Then there's Dharma. The artha and kama are for all people, whether they're atheists or religious or whatever they are. Artha and kama is there. Dharma is for people who believe really in something greater, in Ishvara, in transmigration, the reincarnation, all of that. Because with Dharma is so important to the trajectory of your next life. It's also your, for the next life that you take. It's also important for your own shanti in this life, but sometimes people don't realize that. But they all know that it's important for the next life, because when you look at the transmigration of the jiva, it's not evolution. Reincarnation is not evolution. That means that it's dharma-based. So it can go like this and like this.
It
can
be devolution also.
Yeah, it can. Yeah, that's right. It depends upon dharma. So you can be given a wonderful life and then, you know, behave adharmically in that life for whatever reasons. Or you can, you know, each life you learn from your mistakes and you mature. And sometimes people don't mature. They go off the wagon, so to speak. You know, and so dharma is not just, reincarnation is just not an ascent. So, at the end of your life, what that final thought is, who you are, Coleman, that thought that, you know, kind of embraces the totality of yourself, sets the trajectory and attracts the prarabdha karmas. Also, there's different levels of experience the jiva can go on to exhaust punya and papa. You know, in different subtle planes.
The lokas.
Lokas. You know, so, but that's all based upon your karma. But when we're talking about taking a birth here, we call it prarabdha karma.
So how come someone who attains self-knowledge, why isn't this sanchitta karma file waiting? And say they have, you know, might not have a great thought at the end of their life. They might be thinking, you know, they might be still having their prarabdha karma file, and might be thinking, oh shit, you know, something. Who knows what they're thinking, you know?
Yeah.
We're in the hospital, wherever.
Yeah.
Driving in a car, like, oh,
yeah.
This guy just cut in front of me, and then they die.
Yeah. So what they're saying with the sanchitta and other karmas, from the standpoint of the jiva, who has knowledge, there's already no identification with that. There's no karta. There's karmas, but there's no karta. There's actions, but no doer. Karta means the doer.
Okay.
That's resolved. So all of these sanchitta karmas just go back into the ether, actually. There's nobody to own them. That's what they say.
Someone else gets them?
Well, actually, you know. They,
possibly.
You know what they say? I think
the students get them.
Yeah. But no. What they say kind of is a, I don't know, it's like a praise or like a, you know, watch out how you treat your teacher. What they say, this is in the Tattva Bodha. It says, when the guru, the jnani dies, those people who have treated him well, I can't remember the Sanskrit exactly how they say this, but those who have treated him well, you know, get all his punya, and all those punya karmas go into their accounts, and the ones that have, you know, treated him badly, they get all the papa karmas. No, I don't know.
We like to think of it that way.
You said there's no one there to pick up that file, whatever.
Yeah, there's no. Yeah, that's right.
And by no one, you mean there's no sukshma sharira.
Yeah, that all goes. That all dissipates.
But that the sukshma sharira exists up until the last moment. It just dissipates at the end.
Yeah.
And why does that? Why
just
does
like
it
the
dissipate?
Well, because there's no ajnanam there. There's no ahankara to hold it together, because there's no ajnanam.
So it needs an ahankara to hold
it
through it the transition from one life to another.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right, because when the ahankara is a false character anyway, right, what is really just there is changeless me. And when the mind, your mind already, its home is the self, even while you're alive. Its home and its place of residence, so to speak, where it revels, where it lives, where it enjoy likes to be, is only with the Atma. And from that position it experiences Ishwara, it experiences the world. So there's no jiva there. The jiva is excited by raga dvesha, really. You, even as an ajnani, there's times, several times when you're this ahankara is not being excited. It's with the raga dvesha that excite the ahankara, that jivatvam. Otherwise, there's just being, you know. We wouldn't recognize that until you have knowledge, but once you have knowledge, then you'll see out there. And there's plenty of times when that ahankara, that jivatva is not activated because there's nothing the mind wants. You have plenty of times in your life where there may be momentary, but where the mind doesn't want anything. So it's just simply abiding. You know, it's not asking the world to be different. It's just the being with the experience that is there. You know? But here forward, once one has knowledge, the home base, its home is Atma, is the Brahman, is the self. And so when the body dies, the mind's pravritti means its inclination, is only toward yourself. It's not toward, oh, let me have this body, or let me do this, or let me do that. There's no outward motion, you know, to keep that jiva going. Whereas for a jiva, there's nothing but outward motion, looking and what's going on, and, you know, there's the ahankara and identification with that sukshma sharira. That's its reality. But that's not so for one who has knowledge. Already, while you're living, what happens is as your mind matures, that engagement with the world as a jiva becomes more and more mithya, or thinner and thinner, because it enjoys being home. It's a homebody. It likes to stay home and then experience the world as it is, because that's so easy. If you're not asking the world to give you your ananda, then what is easiest and most comfortable is to live out the prarabdha karma that is your life. The prarabdha karma is not somebody else's life. And that prarabdha karma you have. So that prarabdha karma is one with Ishwara. And so if you're not projecting onto your life, then you're just living the prarabdha karma, which is one with Ishwara, you know, and taking things as they come. There's a lot of beautiful verses about Mahatmas and Jnanis, you know, how they take things as, they take the things that come their way. And they use it in kind of a poetic language. Whatever comes their way is what they take, what they have. That sounds poetic, you know, and wow. But really, what is coming your way is your prarabdha karma, and it is always coming your way every moment. You know? And so say if you understand that, then what they're saying is almost a statement of the obvious. It's not a mystical statement. Like I'm this divine being, this great Mahatma, is just waiting for things to float in. And whatever floats by, falls at his feet, those things he will take. It isn't that. It's that every moment is the prarabdha karma. Every single moment. That moment is yours. It totally belongs to you. You know, the whole world, you know, the whole prarabdha karma is your life, and you don't have to do anything about it except be present to it. That's why what Swamiji said that time, I've repeated it so many times, I think, but Swamiji once said, I just do whatever is in front of me to be done in the best way that I can. That's it. That's what he said, and that's it. It's nothing more than that. That's all I do. I'm not doing anything. It's just whatever is here. I respond to whatever is here in the best way that I can. That's the power of the karma, you know. And there could be nothing more easy than that. The problem is because we've picked up desires along the way, you know, we don't want our power of the karma because we already have that. See, that's the thing. The power of the karma you already have completely. You don't have to worry about it at all. But then when you want other things, then the other things aren't happening. And then you're just stuck with your prarabdha karma because you want the other things. What about when you don't want the other things? You just, this prarabdha karma is fine. It's like saying Ishwara is fine. Mm-hmm. Now, this is my little piece of Ishwara from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs. And we have that so you can be very comfortable and just rest there because there's no conflict. It's your place in the creation. Here you are. See what I mean?
And karma yoga kind of imitates that.
Yes.
Well enough to give you shanti.
Exactly. Karma yoga is an attitude which matches reality until your knowledge has really recognized it. So karma yoga takes the mind to a place of shanti, you know, that is almost identical to what a jnani enjoys naturally. So close, it's just a hair's breadth, because the kartritvam is still there, but the attitude, you know, as all of this is Ishwara, that even though that jiva is still there, you know, that doership is still there, the attitude is, this is all Ishwara, and I accept it all as prasad, that prasada buddhi. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what the jnani does, it's just the kartritvam isn't there. You recognize that your being is Ishwara. Or the karma yoga, the jiva is still there, devoted to Ishwara, instead of being Ishwara, recognizing all of this as Ishwara. It's just the slightest little shift. In fact, if you see that, that's a big thing to see. It's true. That's what it is. Well...